Hello there, Thinking Fellows listeners. This is your host, Caleb Keith, and I'm with my father, Dr. Scott Keith. And, you know, it's almost 7 years, so we get a little slack on this one. We're going to post our first correction ever. Now, that doesn't mean we haven't been wrong in those 7 years about minutia, but I think this time actually warranted the first correction. So, Dad, do you want to make your correction?
Yeah, so what happened is in the last two episodes of the Chronicles of Narnia series, in The Magician's Nephew and The Last Battle, I mentioned many times that I had been reading C.S. Lewis's Beyond Personality, and mentioned that as sort of his lectures on medievalism that he gave. That, in fact, is a mistake. The book that I should have been referring to is The Discarded Image. So every time during the next two shows you hear Beyond Personality, substitute in your mind The Discarded Image. What had happened was over the weekend I read Beyond Personality, started on The Discarded Image on Monday, was really influenced by The Discarded Image. I really like it. It really helped me clarify some things in Magician's Nephew and The Last Battle, but had Beyond Personality on the brain. Mm-hmm. So the problem here is in this series getting me too excited about Lewis, and in the last 3 weeks I've read, like,
just reading a lot and Abolition of mixing
Man,
the
Beyond
titles
Personality,
up.
Surprised by Joy, Discarded
so,
Image.
So really, just as a final, the book, the only book outside of Chronicles of Narnia really being referenced in the next two episodes
is The Discarded Image.
Is The Discarded Image. So I'll try to type out something similar in the show notes for those.
I apologize for my mistake.
Apologize there. Somebody may notice, but I'm just going to post this at the beginning of both episodes. So following this message right now, you're going to hear our full episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco, as we continue to discuss, actually, for the last time, the seven books in the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis. As you can tell, we are on the last book, which is titled The Last Battle. Before we talk about that, The Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of Shows and 1517.org. You can go to 1517.org to see everything we do there. 1517 produces resources, digital and physical, and in the form of conferences and gatherings. And you can go check those out. Those resources range from audio, like podcasts, video on our YouTube channel. You can search 1517 on YouTube and subscribe there. We have physical resources in the form of a publishing house. I think, how many books a year are we up to, Dad? 10? 11?
Well, that's a good question, Brad. I think we're at 12 or 14.
Yeah, it's about a dozen.
A dozen books a year. The catalog has began filling out, so you can check that out.
It's huge for a small company or really is. Business. It's actually impressive.
For how many people we have involved at publishing, which is to say just a very small handful of people, it has become incredible to see how many books we can push out. I'm guessing publishers of our size would usually put out two or three books a year. And so I think we've tried to pour a lot of energy into that, and it's really turned out well. You can go to shop.1517.org to see the books there.
Adam and I are going to write a book on Chronicles of Narnia.
We are?
No.
I have Narnia. I have to admit, I have Narnia fatigue.
Oh, do you?
Well, I think only because my schedule and just trying to fit it in, and
it was a bit of a push for me. I love with this last one. It's just been finding the time.
Like, let's go on to the space trilogy, baby.
That's because you have a empty nest.
I think so. I really do. I'm like, I've been sitting at night, like thinking, like, how am I going to finish this book? And he texts me. He's like, done. Where are you? I'm like, I'm on chapter two. Yeah, could you leave me alone? Like,
he does. He shames me too.
The other thing, the other trick he did. Is this time you listened to some of it, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I didn't. And after we got through part of it, I was like, this would have been easier to finish if I had gone audiobook. But I didn't go audiobook. I flipped pages.
It's easier and better to do with novels, especially novels that you've read before, too. I mean, I'm a fan of audiobooks. I know not everybody is, but for me, I'm a pretty good auditory learner, as they say. So it's not hard for me. I retain a lot of recall even with audiobooks. A lot of people don't, so I get that. But I'll even say like with we talked about in the last episode, Abolition of Man and Beyond Personality. If you would have been introduced to those works as Lewis intended them, they would have been lectures. So they would have been audio anyway. It was only later, after he had given the lectures many, many times, that somebody said, provide a little bit more permanence to these, and they were published as books, which I really wish any lecture, a series of lectures I've ever given in my life, people begged me to publish.
That has not happened. I think that is an extreme editing task. We've had people write into 1517 asking to convert certain podcasts into books. So let's say, 40 minutes is a good example, 40 minutes and 30 minutes. Could you take the commentary that you did on this book of the Bible, let's say Genesis,
and edit it into a volume,
and have it transcribed and make it a book? The problem is that the conversation is less like a formal lecture.
Well, I think Lewis was giving these as lectures, and Adam could explain it better. But when you at Oxford in the undergrad, you have a tutor, and you go meet with your tutor, but your tutor isn't lecturing you in your tutoring sessions. Instead, your tutor will put together lectures that are open to the entire student body of the University of Oxford. Whether or not Lewis is your tutor, or whether or not you go to modeling college or whatever, you can just show up to these lectures that are done by C.S. Lewis, tutor at modeling college. They'd be advertised probably way back then just in whatever print sort of catalog they did at the university on a weekly basis of lectures that were happening. These are all online now. I mean, when you go now, I mean, for me, the one that I remember the most is I attended a lecture series on Blackfriars that was on the Summa Theologiae of Thomas Aquinas, and I think it was 14 days.
You went to Blackfriars?
Yeah, it was a 14-day series or something like that, yeah. And it's quite good. Parts of it that were really surprising to me, but I still would like a Blackfriars edition of the Summa.
So
expensive. Maybe that's a Caleb. That's a hint for Christmas next year, I think.
Or his birthday. His birthday's coming sooner.
Hey, you mentioned Abolition of Man. Are we intending to do that next?
I would love to. Three lectures.
We need to do this. We need to pause. We got to do a Q&A episode. We have some questions.
We're not allowed to make production
to do.
Plans.
Yeah, and, we can't. Sorry.
We do have an obligation to answer a couple questions on air.
Are they Narnia questions?
No. They're not Narnia questions. All right. Then we had one Narnia question that I answered via email. But and then we can move on to something else, like the Abolition of Man, which would be interesting. So
yeah, three lectures. You do it in three episodes.
Yeah. A little more philosophy, as it were.
I actually think there'd be a good tie-in to stuff we've been talking about offline quite a bit, which is sort of epistemology and education, because that's what it is.
I think that's the best angle for it. But
I can't tell you how many, I don't know if they're podcasts or wherever I'm picking it up, because I've got so much noise in my head. Maybe it's just me talking to myself, but everybody's saying, you got to read The Abolition of Man, and others are saying, alongside of it, read The Brave New World, Huxley's book, or they said,
you've
we're
read
there.
You've read Brave New World, right?
Yeah, a couple times.
There was,
I've read it.
What?
Have you read it, Caleb?
Brave New World? No. But I know.
It's an inside family joke.
It's an inside family joke. But I actually have it on audiobook, because after I read, what's that book about TV being bad?
Fahrenheit?
No. Amusing Yourself to Death.
Amusing Yourself to Death. You know, Neil Postman's thesis in chapter one is that we're not living in 1984, we're living in Brave New World.
My thesis is?
We live in both.
We live in both.
Yeah. So after
Fahrenheit 451 in there too? We're living in all three?
Sure.
Well, I think you really...
Yeah. It's a multiverse.
Really, it's not this episode, but you really do live in both, because you do have the sort of Amusing Yourself to Death, Neil Postman, Brave New World, Soma, Soma, Soma stuff, but you also do have doublespeak, crazy going on right now, so... and, you know, the big thing in 1984 is we're not at war with them. We're at war with them. Like, and we've always been at war with them. And everyone's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So now, speaking of war, we have a different war to talk about this episode. And that's the last battle here, C.S. Lewis. The final book, no matter which order you've been reading the books in, we can finally bring an end to this dead horse.
There are a couple horses in this.
And there are a couple horses, dead ones. No, this is the last book. So no matter what, no matter what order you read them in, this
I'm going to be a little bit critical of Lewis here, which I have not.
Oh, I was going to say this is from the theological perspective, where all my disagreements with Lewis come to light.
Oh, that I wasn't going to say that. I'd be interested to hear about that. But what I was going to say is this is the of all the Narnia books, just as a piece of literature, and we all know I'm a fine critic of literature.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Right.
that this is the most hodgepodge of all the books.
Oh yeah.
This is
plot line is muddy here.
I mean, if you're 12 and reading this, you're just doing this for fun because following along, there are so many open questions. Like, all of a sudden, characters are introduced that are obviously significant, but they're not really introduced that well in their role. And all of a sudden,
can we talk about the names too? I know we talked about this before, but the name Puzzle.
Yeah.
Really? Shift.
I actually thought
Jewel.
I actually thought that with Diggory last time too. I was like, did he take a trip to Australia? Like what?
And like, can I have another bigger one? Like where? And I know that there's some introduction to it, so don't just go, well, this is where they come in. But all of a sudden, where are the Calamarine coming from? Like, all of a sudden, it's like all of a, the whole story is on Puzzle and Schiff, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the whole story is on the Talamarines that are like taking over, and you're like, and all of a sudden,
Calamarines,
and all of a sudden, like talking animals are getting sold into slavery, and this is just all happening really fast and without much explanation of what's going on.
Maybe that's sort of a point, right? Is that the end of the world doesn't
come like a thief in the night?
Well, or you don't really see it coming. It's just like all these horrible events that are like happening as the natural course of history.
But I would have loved the narrator to say, some of these things had been happening for a long time, but they had had their eyes closed to them. Because the narrator has done that in previous books, that type of thing in previous books. And it just wasn't done here. All of a sudden, you know, this starts with a really weird sort of an ape and a donkey find a lion skin in a pool. I mean, it starts, the crux of the story. It starts, of course, with the Narnian people, the Earth Narnians are all getting together for a Narnian reunion and all that. But like the crux of the thing, a lion skin shows up in a pool, the monkey throws it on the donkey, starts calling donkey Aslan, and then Narnia is completely invaded. It's like, boom, Narnia is invaded. And you're like,
So there's, I guess what you could say is, I mean, we could help smooth some of this out. In the explanation, since we can manipulate this to be whatever we want it to be, this is our world, all right? is that you have two major plot points? You have like a fake Aslan, and you have somebody using Aslan's name for their own gain. So Shift especially is gaining off of Puzzle's sort of misery and going along with pretending to be Aslan.
He's gaining off of the lie that Puzzle is Aslan so that he can get the squirrels to bring him nuts.
So we have one story in sort of like lying about the name of God and about the power associated with that and the fear associated with that.
That's a big theme here. Lying about the name of God is a big theme throughout this book.
And then the second one is sort of what's happening in the backdrop while and you kind of get the sense that this is, I feel like it's highlighting a bigger issue, which is forgetting who Aslan is, using Aslan as a mere threat to other people to gain. And so it's a commentary on the state of world religion in Narnia.
Syncretism too, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Am I pronouncing this correctly?
Yes.
You know, the combination of Aslan and Tash. Yeah. Tashland. Yeah. That reminded me of, I mean, I can't get it out of my head. There's this movement that sprung up maybe 20 years ago called Chrislam. It's a fusion of Christianity and Islam.
I bet you can't get that out of your head. Holy cow.
Abrahamic faith kind of talk. It drives me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the initial big theme, because that syncretism theme comes in near the end. It's not common throughout the whole thing. It comes in.
But it's part of the common problem.
But it comes in once Tash is introduced.
Yeah.
And then they start saying Tash and Aslan are the same. That's when they go to Tashland. But then the dwarves start going, who cares? The dwarves are for the dwarves. I don't give one rip snort about Tash or Aslan or Tashland. They're all lies. I think the big sort of initial theme in this is that by the time the end has come, most will have forgotten the name of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you?
Confused it with another thing,
or just been so indifferent about it. Mm-hmm. And you will certainly have some epic faithfuls at the end. King Tyrion, Jewel.
Mm-hmm.
I even forgot the name of the one dwarf who's like, I'm in with you guys. And so that's the big theme. But the two big settings, and this is sort of the first time for Lewis and Narnia. The two big settings here are Earth and Narnia.
Mm-hmm.
There is this whole Earth thing where Peter, Edmund, Diggory, Polly, Lucy, Eustace, and Jill are basically coming together for a Narnia reunion. And because Professor Kirk, i.e. Diggory, has a premonition that they need to all be in the same place. And so they're kind of getting together for a British tea type thing. And we'll discuss Narnia and all those times when we met Aslan.
Throughout the series of Narnia, Scott, you've increasingly affected a British accent here. it's quite, reminds me of some of those goofballs over in England studying where they all of a sudden take on this British accent and British mannerisms.
As I sport my like 10-inch beard and a flannel, that's interesting. And that's the one setting, right? And again, you know, stuff starts to go awry in Narnia,
mm-hmm.
With Tyrion. the funny thing is that Tyrion and Jewel, who's a unicorn, but not Tyrion's horse. He doesn't ride Jewel. He's just Tyrion's buddy. Like, Jewel the Unicorn.
My pal the Unicorn.
It's just Tyrion's buddy. They're, like, sitting around drinking beers at the hunting lodge when this all starts. And, Jewel, would you like another beer?
I have a terrible distaste for unicorns. I've read so many unicorn books in my life to my daughters, including one called Uni the Unicorn, mm-hmm. who wondered if humans existed.
Mm-hmm.
And she, of course, knew they did exist because... Or she would sit around and wonder if humans wondered about the existence of unicorns the way she wondered about the existence of humans, so therefore they all must exist. Sorry.
That's funny.
That was a segue.
But they, basically Tyrion and Jewel, you know, they're kind of led into something's amiss in Narnia. As they're going to investigate... They run into a Calamarin,
mm-hmm.
and they murder him. The big thing that starts sort of the end for Tyrion as king is the fact that he acts dishonorably towards this Calamarin at the beginning, and then has regret about that, and basically goes and turns himself in to them for.
Unjust murder.
Killing this guy before he even had a chance to draw his sword. That single thing there kind of really starts the end of Narnia.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of single act there. I mean, the stuff that Shift and Puzzle are doing certainly contributes. Even later on, the the weird sort of tricksterism of the cat, which is just a weird insertion, by the way, Lewis. That's just a weird insertion in this. has stuff to do with it, too. But really, I think you guys can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but the crux point of this story here is that Tyrion's sin, even though he's an honorable guy, believer in Aslan, calls on the name of Aslan, his sin sort of starts the end of the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Because otherwise he would have just gone to Cair Paravel. He would have gotten his army before the Calamarans attacked Cair Paravel. He would have gotten his army. He would have marched the army to Lantern Waste and would have taken care of the problem the way he should have. But instead, he happens upon this Calamaran scout and murders him and then feels the guilt, goes and turns himself in. He and Jewel are captured. At that point, it's when he's captured that he's literally kind of praying for Aslan, and he sees the gathering of...
Yeah, he has a vision.
The vision of the earthly Narnians, and sees the great the High King Peter. At that point, Aslan sends Eustace and Jill into Narnia to help Tyrion. And, he escapes, but they don't really make it far before Narnia comes to an end via the last battle. I mean, the armies of Cair Paravel are destroyed before they can even come help.
Yeah.
Ruin, the centaur, is murdered. The only survivor is the eagle, who comes to tell him the tale of the fall of Cair Paravel. And so it's just, it happens fast. Once that part starts happening,
oh yeah,
no more drinking beer with a unicorn at the hunting lodge.
Yeah, that's no, that is sort of one of the things is you'd almost expect that like the story would come in the middle of the end of days, right? So like if I were...
No, it and comes at the end of the end of days.
If I was this great author who had all these ideas, you know, you would probably start in the middle, tell a little bit of backstory of how the end of days started, and then move into this is like...
How many generations does Tyrion say he is from Caspian? Is it 100?
Supposedly like...
Sounds right.
The amount of years that Narnia's existed total from the magician's nephew to this is only 2,500 years. So
it's maybe 12 or something like that generations then. I don't know, but he's descendant of.
It could be 100 because you could have 1,000 years between Caspian and the end, and you could have had 500 to 1,000 years between the children and Caspian.
Yeah.
And then there was 500 years before that.
I think it's interesting that Tyrion, I think, tells Jill, who's like, Jill's like, every time I come to Narnia, there's this crazy stuff happening. And Tyrion's like, well, don't get a bad impression of Narnia. It's not always like this. In fact, there's some line that, in fact, most of Narnia's history is barely worth mentioning. I thought that was awesome. He's like, we have the witch, the 100 years winter. We have the great kings and queens of Narnia. We've got Caspian. We've got that weird story about the horse and his boy. And when my descendant was captured by the Green Witch. Mm-hmm. And other than that, it's all kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the impression that Lewis has given you all the highlights of Narnia.
Yeah. I think the big other piece of this, like, is just the returning of characters from all the books, both human and non-human. There's the return of many characters that you recognize. And also picking pieces out, especially like the Silver Chair. There are pieces from the Silver Chair there's a whole section of the Silver Chair that is about, you know, prophesying about the end of days. And so all those prophecies now start to sort of come
Silver
to fruition.
Chair has a little bit of Ezekiel going on.
Mm-hmm. And the Father Time actually coming from Silver Chair.
Right, and is now finally here.
Yeah, doing his job, bringing the stars down.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
That are people,
and provide...
Because they've met one before.
And provide light at the very end.
Yeah. In fact, Caspian married the daughter of a star.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like all that part of it. I just think this... And I actually really like the last third. I just think this front setup is just so hodgepodge and kind of convenient, right? It's kind of convenient that we find out that not only are the Narnian children, shall we say, all in one place in Earth and all die, essentially, from the train crash, but that also the Pevensey parents are coming in on the train that crashes into the station, and they die too. And of course, the only one that doesn't die and is still left to sort of rot on Earth for a while is
Susan,
because she was always thought of herself as a little too grown up.
Which also, Susan, like from an outside perspective, Susan's world has just, like, she's going to now a mass funeral.
Oh yeah,
like everybody she's ever known and loved is dead.
Yeah, she's really only gonna have parties to look forward to.
Yeah, that's like, whew. So
that is one criticism that they did bring up in the McGrath podcast, is that this is kind of a dark tale for children. But I thought, being of somebody who experienced at least three very prominent deaths as a child, children ought to know that death is reality.
Yeah, I think so. I was like sort of, I don't remember who I was talking to, but they were talking about that it's really common for children to now be, actually at all stages of life, uninvited from the important stages of, well, funerals, but this starts with weddings. So it's like, it's really common now to say no children at my wedding. In fact, I've been to a wedding where that was on the invitation. It was like, no children.
It stays about me.
Then when I asked, it was because, well, children might interrupt the service, you know? Like, it's the same thing.
I always
like,
thought it was just a cost thing.
No, this one was like, oh, yeah.
Not even invited to the ceremony.
They screamed during the ceremony. Yeah. Wow. It was complete uninvite. And I guess that's not totally uncommon, especially when amongst my generation. And I think overwhelming distaste for children. But, and then for children not to be, like, to not come to funerals as well. So for them to be left at home.
Yeah.
Or with a sitter or whatever.
Yeah.
During funerals. And
I'm glad that there's so much death and new life in this.
Yeah.
That makes any sense. Because that's the promise, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the curse and the promise. Right? You will surely die. But I have died for you and thus you will surely live. So that as far as criticisms go, I've got much more, you know, I think substantial criticisms, then it's a little morbid for children for it.
Yeah. No. My criticism would be the very quickly after the introduction of Father Time and the drawing down of the stars, Aslan talks about real Narnia and real London to the children.
Yes.
And this I really dislike.
And the professor goes, it's all in Plato. It's all in Plato. Yeah. What are they teaching you these days?
And I just really dislike the idea that Narnia wasn't the real Narnia. You know, London, our world isn't real. We're all sort of, so it's the limbo.
Can we say two things about, well, Adam's been trying to say something. Go for it, Adam. And
I'll I was going to jump on the Plato bit, but I can.
Go for it.
It's just one of my favorite lines.
Because
it just reminds me of, I mean, takes me back in church history, you know, to like Augustine, Plato's a friend.
Yeah.
And I've been, Caleb, you've accused me of being a Thomist on this show, I think.
And now you're an Augustinian Platonist.
Well, I mean, I quite like Scott, you and I are both Platonists in a bit, or in a way, aren't we? Remember our like weeks-long conversation about why would anybody even practice music or art?
If there were
it's like, because there's good, better, and best. It's a very Platonic idea.
That's a good question for if we do Abolition of Man, because that's how that whole book starts. I think you get criticized to Platonism in this with that one line, the real Narnia, the real London. I think that's an unfortunate characterization, because Narnia was obviously real. The old Narnia was obviously real. And in fact, Lucy weeps for it. And when she's scolded for weeping, she defends her weeping and then is defended for her weeping for it. So it's obviously real.
Mm-hmm. I think his Platonism, his Christian Platonism, which is sort of my real problem. I don't have a problem with Plato. I have a problem with Christian Platonism.
So, but Christian and Platonism is usually sort of disembodied Christianity. In other words, when you talk about Christian Platonism, the problem is it usually leads to Gnosticism, which is matter bad, spirit good. And that's obviously not Lewis, and that's obviously not Lewis in this last battle either, because the new Narnia is also a physical Narnia. And so while I think that there are...
Yeah, I just don't think he has the right words. I think really needs new and old, new heaven, new earth. Yeah, he needs the words from Scripture, not from Plato.
I agree with that. It's the one word. It's the real. The real is what got me to... But then I started thinking about it. This would be sort of Gnostic, Platonic, Gnostic kind of crap. Or like extreme Platonism. All these philosophies, it drives me crazy even when you talk about like empiricism and rationalism. Nobody lives their life as a hard empiricist, and nobody lives their life as a hard rationalist, because you just can't, right? We all sort of lend one way or the other, but then make exceptions for the practicalities of living everyday life. I'd say the same thing with like Platonism versus Aristotelianism. And in fact, I think Aristotelianism is misunderstood as being sort of anti-Platonic. It's, you know, right. It's all the stuff and none of the other, and Platonism is all the other and none of the actual stuff. Whereas Aristotle's encounter with the real stuff, the stuff he could interact with,
was
to get to the other.
Yeah.
Was to
our,
learn
our listeners
as
are
much
playing,
as he,
what the heck are they talking about?
Was to learn as much as he could about the other, at least, right? In this limited form of the real stuff here. And I think that where Christianity has always gone wrong with this is they've disembodied Christ out of this, which is why, you know, this kind of Christian Platonism has often been what's led to some of the Christological heresies that disembody Christ.
Well, and even when it's not doing that, let's say at the time of the Reformation where... I mean, Luther's really attacking Platonism. That's why he gets accused of being a nominalist.
I just listened to that nominalist episode.
I thought we just recorded that. Did that go out?
Just went out this week. I listened to it on the way down the mountain.
You guys recorded on nominalism?
No,
I was going to call you, but it was, even though I was...
Because that's my jam, baby.
Even though I was up on the West Coast, I figured that you would still be asleep in Chicago because it was like 5 o'clock in the morning.
When was this?
This morning.
Oh.
And I want to bundle Melanchthon into this as well, right? The first Loci is really an attack on Platonism, is because when it talks about God, it's always talking about the idea of God. It's talking about God from his attributes, not God from his revelation in Christ.
We can't talk about this now, but Adam, I have to talk to you after this episode about Melanchthon, the manuscript, Beyond Personality, Medievalism. Okay. And the section that I wrote in the manuscript on scholasticism.
Okay. Well, so this is good because this is kind of why I bring up the Plato bit. The whole series is like we talked last episode. C.S. Lewis is very pre-modern, right? I just love how he intertwines Christian themes with pagan themes with Greek philosophy, yes. As if Greek philosophy and paganism it's not like they're totally wrong. They're sort of like, they
shadows.
Point you in the right direction, kind of, sort of.
Types and shadows. Types and shadows.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that's Lewis Marcus, who's a C.S. Lewis scholar, at, I think Houston Baptist University is.
That's
his major...
Lewis makes this whole sort of extended argument in Beyond Personality when it comes to, like, whether you're talking about natural law, whether you're talking about sort of the mystical laws that you would have thought of sort of medieval ascetics type stuff or whatever, or St. Paul talking about the law of God written on your heart, which Lewis argues in the Hebrew would be your mind. Mm-hmm. That this is all sort of it's that, right? It's that they're not wrong; they're just not the whole thing,
right?
And it's the whole thing, i.e.
And the problem
in Narnia, the real Aslan, yeah. or in our world, the real Christ that dies and rises for you, that is the actual thing.
And the problem is when people with the actual thing go, that one over there seems better.
And it gets to syncretism, which is, gets us back to the last battle, because one of the things that that ends up happening is that all the Narnians, even as Tyrion comes back and they're fighting the battle at the stable. As they come back, you get the introduction of Tash, which is sort of the Calamaran god, big, ugly crow's bird head.
Yeah.
Ugh, I didn't like that. birds freak me out.
Because they can pluck eyes and eyes.
Oh, yeah,
freak you out.
Birds freak me out. Like, I get why they are, like, associated with the occult and whatnot, because I look at a crow and I'm creeped out. And so that's why I go bird hunting.
Yeah, that's why.
but then, you know, there's obviously a power to Tash that is real.
Oh, yeah, he's real.
They can feel it, right? That things get colder, it gets
banished.
Darker.
I mean,
it's banished. It's real. But at the same time, the dwarves who've just stopped believing in anything, they're kind of unaffected by either Tash or Aslan at that point, which is, I think, an interesting sort of way of looking at atheist, maybe. I mean, mm-hmm. essentially the dwarves become atheists here. Dwarves are for the dwarves. People are for the people. There's nothing else. Right? There's nothing but us. And so that's an interesting thing to me. And then you get the twist with the sort of the faithful Calamaran soldier. I mean, the stable where Puzzle was pretending to be Aslan, the shift made him live, sort of becomes the junction point between the old Narnia and the new Narnia, right? And as a punishment for losing the battle, people are shoved into this puzzle, into the stable where Tash is supposedly going to kill him, right? Mm-hmm. And so people don't want to get pushed in here, and the cat gets pushed in here, and he comes out screaming. He's no longer a talking cat. He's a dumb cat. But this soldier goes in there willingly, and you later encounter him, and even though he's a believer in Tash, when he encounters Aslan tells him a really interesting thing, which I think isn't I wouldn't call it quite a correct theological thing, but it's an interesting thing to think about. He tells the soldier anything that's ever been good that was done in the name of Tash was actually done in the name of Aslan. Anything bad that was ever done in the name of Aslan was done in the name of Tash. Now, it's a really convenient way of explaining sort of Christian things that Christians have done in the name of God or Christ in the past that were obviously evil, mm-hmm. i.e. Inquisition type stuff, or anything that sort of the modern woke culture might call out Christianity for. It's kind of convenient to say, well, mm-hmm. they did that. They said they were doing that in the name of Jesus, but they were actually doing that in the name of the devil, which is not an untrue thing to say. But I would think in our age, it would just think people would think it a rather convenient. Yeah.
It only makes sense if you've got a Christian worldview to begin with, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the one sense, the other thing I don't like about it is it makes the lie that things were done in God's name, like, less significant, right? So it makes the harm less significant, because really there's this secret knowledge that those things really aren't of God.
Well, it also, I actually think the flip side of that is more theologically dangerous, that good things that you might be doing in mm-hmm. the name of a false God are actually in the name of Jesus. To me, that's more theologically dangerous than the other
that's
one.
That's also,
because that's like anti-Romans 10.
Well, and I would also argue part of the Platonism, because good is good and yes. good comes from God. And this is actually part of the major problem with Christian Platonism is that all good things come from God, and good is good no matter what. Who's doing it? And so
I definitely think Lewis struggles with that in his books.
He doesn't quite have the who is doing it part. So, like, those who are of Aslan and those who are not. So it makes things good. So he's missing part of it is that it is the word that makes things good.
Well, the argument here could be that there's a bit of a universalism going on here, that it doesn't actually matter whether or not you call on the name of Aslan. It just matters whether or not you were good.
Mm-hmm.
To me, beyond the like real Narnia, fake Narnia, whatever, that's the theologically worst part of this book is that single line there.
Yeah.
Because most people will miss what you said, I think, about the real Narnia and the new Narnia or the old Narnia. But most people aren't going to miss
this part,
that anything that you do that's good, even if it's in the name of another god, is done for God. That's literally what decent non-believers think. Like, I could name my friends from Carson City that... Mm-hmm. That's literally their position in life, is that they're not necessarily calling on the name of Jesus. They're not necessarily not, right? But they're not necessarily calling on the name of Jesus, but they believe wholeheartedly that in this life, if they do good things, it will be in the name of whatever God offers salvation, probably Jesus.
It's like a works righteousness Pascal's wager.
Yeah.
That's
the worst part of this to me. I would have actually much preferred that the Calamaran been forgiven for worshiping Tash,
then
fallen on his knees, and then Aslan absolved him and say, I count all these things, you know,
in my name.
Yeah. Like, claimed them rather than saying they were done in his name. As if the dude was actually a believer in Aslan.
Again, I do think that has to do...
That would be my Lutheran twist to The Last Battle.
Yeah.
If I were to rewrite it, that's...
I mean, part of it just has to do with the conception of good being placed here.
Yeah,
which
I
doesn't
got it.
Have to do with who you belong to.
I've read a little Plato.
Yeah. And, I mean, and a little Luther, right? And so it makes sense. But, yeah, that's just where some of this is lacking for us.
Yeah, that was the big fall short. The part of it that's pretty is after that, because I think I've said on this show before, I have a hard time with conceptions of heaven. Like, when like you go to church and you're growing up and heaven is this place that you go after you die if you believe in Jesus, and then you get assigned your choir robe and you go
to this endless liturgy.
Yeah, you go to this little singing tryout, and you figure out whether you're a bass or a tenor, and then they kind of put you in your spot, and then some dude in a different color robe is going to get up there and shake a wand at you for your eternity, and you're just going to sing. I'm like, phew, I love Jesus. I'm not sure I love heaven. And so any sort of work of fiction, you know, that presents me with a picture that's more like a new heaven and a new earth, where you even get the possibility, and not explicitly though, but you even get the possibility that the vocations that were provided to the Pevensey children are going to follow forward in the new Narnia. And I really, that's... This is my own bias here, but that's really appealing to me. And so the fact that Narnia is still Narnia, they start recognizing landmarks, right? But they're like, well, I think that's Mount blah, 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 but sure is bigger, you know, and more real. I like that because it's still Narnia. It's still physical. They're still there physically. They're interacting with it physically. Their physical interacting is different than it was in Narnia. While in Narnia, you know, they even mentions in this that Jill and Eustace, by day two, seem bigger to Tyrion than they did when they got there, right? But in the new Narnia, like, they run and they don't get tired. Man, I get tired all the time now, so that's sort of appealing to me. I just thought that part of it, what it's literally, the turn for me is after the scene with the Calamaran, the faithful Calamaran.
I would say it
gets much better.
The problem still for me ends up being similar to, actually,
Caleb's been hanging out with Paul since.
No,
there will be no Platonism today.
The problem is the same with the Great Divorce, and there's a lot of parallel here. Obviously, he's actually not changed his mind too dramatically by the time he writes both these tales about heaven.
Oh no, Lewis admits his the influence of Plato.
Oh no. But my thing is that in both books, he talks about this next life being more real, in like Great Divorce, it's progressively getting more real as you get farther from hell and closer to heaven, but he never explicitly says that the fault with the old world is sin. It's just not as good as the next world. Old Narnia wasn't not as real as this next one because of the evil introduced into it. You get into this next one, and the mountains are bigger.
Although they go into the fortress where evil first entered Narnia, and they point it out. So I'm not saying you're overplaying it, and I'm not saying you're underplaying it. I'm saying I can definitely see what your point of view here. But at the same time, I do think Lewis is a Platonist, and he's a Christian. I don't think he's a Christian Platonist. Because if you ever read Lewis on like the importance of the physical sacraments and stuff like that, a Christian Platonist, that's not their jam, baby.
I don't think he's very consistent, and I actually think this is part of the
problem. He's not a systematic theologian. No, he's a medieval literature prof.
That's what I'm saying. I was about to say part of this is that this is where he's not a theologian actually comes in, like. By training.
Full on says that too.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I'm just saying this is the point where some of that happens.
This is an argument for reading things that you don't totally agree with.
Oh, I love. Yeah. I read them.
The worst thing about being sort of a Lutheran sort of commentator in our common current world is that there's almost like this prescribed bit of books that you're allowed to read and to which you can refer.
Oh yeah, none of that should be true.
And I hate that. Like I obviously don't love the Platonic aspects of this as they're overplayed, and I do not like the syncretistic aspects of it as Adam pointed out minutes ago. Those are my two least favorite parts. Literary wise, I think it's a hodgepodge. On the negative side, literary-wise, on the positive side, I think the presentation of the new heaven and the new earth, as in the new Narnia and the old Narnia, and even the new London, and even looking across the expanse, and now you can see that these worlds are connected and that they can see London. I think that's all beautiful.
Yeah.
That's where I'll stop.
No, I totally agree. None of this is a charge to not read it. I actually think you have to have pictures even when people are not 100%, and that's part of the thing with literature is there's actually, unlike systematic theology, there's actually room to have a theological misstep like amongst your picture of the way these things work.
And this was all supposed to be fun. Like, when I got into this game in my 20s, it was because it was fun. And the way it happens when you're not allowed to do this is not fun. Yeah. It's soul-killing. It's soul-killing, and you get stuck at being a 10-year-old who's just memorizing, which I'm in favor of for 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
Now we're on a totally different topic, and I'm chomping at the bit, but I don't want to say anything because we're at 46 minutes. Because like you said, Scott,
minutes.
Earlier... That there's this like prescribed list of books that you can refer to, that drives me up a wall.
Oh, it's just so.
I mean, you
bonkers.
See it on in the woke culture, that cancel culture, but you see a sort of a mirror version of it in this quest for total purity, ideological.
Or the hubris groups. To say that somebody that came before you that's obviously smarter than you. Just because they're wrong or on a point or two, have nothing to provide to the overall conversation to which you should read and or refer and or learn.
Yeah, part of that is
just bonkers town.
Part of discouraging
it's all
people.
In Plato. What do they teach the kids these days?
Yeah, like honestly, every person who is going to have a critique of Christian Platonism, if they haven't read Plato, if they don't know that it's all in Plato already. Like you don't have a valid critique. You don't know what's there.
Dude, and if you read the analogy of the cave and you're not like, Ooh.
Yeah.
Right?
Or, yeah, exactly.
My favorite bit from Plato, this isn't like a really famous piece, but it's in Phaedo. It's like right before Plato dies where they're talking about the soul. What's going to happen to the soul? Yeah. And one guy says, it probably just sort of go into the dirt and there he is. Another guy says, no, it's going to transmigrate and float around and so on. And then somebody interjects and says, these theories are interesting. Too bad we can't really know what's going to happen unless we had a word from Theologu, or unless we had divine revelation, a word from God. You know, there, you can't know for certain. And it just suggests to me, I'm probably wrong, that Plato is certainly no pre-Christian kind of Christian, you know, or anonymous Christian or whatever we might call him, but he recognizes, kind of like Wittgenstein did at the early early 20th century, if you have a word from God, then you have certainty. If you don't, the best you got is what you can concoct in your own brain or by observation.
I think Plato knew better than the later interpreters that what he was up to was speculation, and that a word from God can silence speculation. I mean, Wittgenstein certainly said the same things, right?
Montgomery comes along and says, aha!
Yeah.
A gardener.
A little
has
too
entered.
Late.
That was actually a really good interpretation of Montgomery, to say.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You should be, well, the world is full of disagreements, so to try to shelter yourself off from it impossible to actually say that word out to other people.
Like, for instance, and now I don't know where we are in time. In Beyond Personality, you know, because Lewis knows all of these seven heavens, right? He knows them. Like, in these lectures, he knows these things. Like, he knows them better than most of us know almost anything. He knows them. You don't get the impression, though, that just because he knows them and he studies them, that he's trying to, like, keyhole them into every bit of whatever sort of orthodoxy he's holding on to. While at the same time, he can look out for where they've influenced the teaching of Christianity as he encounters it in his time. But he can only do that because he knows these things. And if you don't take the time to familiarize yourself with any of this stuff, like, for example, I'm going to get... That's in a little bit of trouble here with our evangelical friends.
Keep going.
And then we'll call them friends. And I've been defending a little bit of this sort of Platonic interaction here. But I don't think they realize that their biggest sort of influence is probably a more Platonic Christianity.
Some of them are waking up to it, and it's really weird. An American non-denominational... theology right now, and in actually some Baptist theology right now, you know, classical Christian theism and Christian Platonism are really hot. And I think
we're so timely,
right? It's really hot right now. It's very popular to say.
It's because Adam and I stay up on Kirk.
You know, we need to talk from universals. We need to talk from God's nature. What the world needs right now is the truth from the attributes type of
interesting
stuff.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, if they're waking up to it, good. Good on them. Now, wake up to some other stuff, too, and then search the text and, you know, find what you think is, what is the truth. So find the truth. So let the truth find you.
Was it worth it to read these seven books in the last 7 weeks, despite our busy schedules?
Yeah, it was worth it.
Put a bookend on all this.
I loved it. Yeah. It's kind of inspired me. Once I'm done with Beyond Personality, I'm going to reread Space.
It made me wish I could tell stories like Lewis did.
Oh, for sure.
You know, I'm terrible at it. You know, put kids on my lap and my stories are like, it's like some ape, some knuckle dragon.
Do you ever think
thug.
That maybe you might have the aptitude for it and like sit down and start writing one and you get like three sentences in and you're, this is.
I do. Sometimes I'm like, I'm going to be a writer. When I was in high school, that's what I wanted to do is just be a writer. I'm going to write the great American novel. Yeah, right.
Funny. No, very, very good. I'm glad I reread them. So I thought it was a fun exercise. Yeah.
I would recommend for people that did enjoy the series, maybe read them along with us. Maybe it's their first encounter or first series encounter with them, maybe even. If they did want to move on to some more fiction that's akin to this, but a little more complex, I would move on to the Space Trilogy. One of the points that we said in here was kind of interesting is that Lewis, I pointed out that that King Rillian says that most of Narnia's history is boring and that you've basically, if you've read these books, you've read every part of the interesting part of Narnia's history. That's a distinction between sort of the Chronicles of Narnia and what Tolkien did, say, in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, where there's like obviously way more going on in the back history, you know, and the other books have come out about it and whatnot. The Space Trilogy gives you a little bit more of sort of that, that it's this same Narnia style, but a little more complex. So if you found yourself liking this, but wishing it weren't just a kid's novel.
And given, by the way, you know, the magician's nephew in The Last Battle could just be happening in another realm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you do read the Space Trilogy, do your best to getting through the last one that I had on my tip of my tongue. I just got rid of it.
Paralyzed. Well, good. All right. Well.
Shoot.
Thank you for listening to this series. We're very glad to have people who made it through all 7 books with us. If you skipped around or you didn't make it through all 7 books, I guess we don't blame you either. It's, you know, I'm guessing not everybody had the same flexible schedule that would have allowed them to read at the same pace as we did. But we hope that these episodes were enjoyable. If this is your first time joining us, we did do the whole series, and you can go back and find those episodes on your favorite podcasting app or on 1517.org. If you'd like to support the Thinking Fellows and our continued efforts, especially as we move on to new episodes and new series, you can go to 1517.org/donate. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.